campaigns, that it's not a threat to the West. It's also sending messages to regional actors. And we're seeing a change, according to regional international actors, towards HTS. Does that mean that HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, is a democratic organization? No, far from it. It is an authoritarian organization with an Islamic fundamentalist ideology, and that is seeking to basically consolidate its power now in Syria. One of the latest indicators is the nomination of a prime minister that was previously the head of the government of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in Idlib. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham's first priority is to consolidate its power in the region it took control over. And this is a challenge for the Syrian democratic and social aspiration of Syrian popular classes in the country. This is why I was saying that we have a lot of Syrians in general have a lot of hope, but also there's contradictions and challenges in the space that was opened by the fall of the regime. And obviously there will be a lot of work of rebuilding to do among democratic and progressive sectors of the society to constitute a bloc to challenge the power of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, but also of the Syrian National Army. And the developments in the following weeks and months will depend on the ability of democratic and social groups to develop, and also, according, as I was saying, to regional and international developments, because a lot of the country, despite their differences, also want to see a form of authoritarian stability reimposed on Syria, that basically meaning a damage control for the region. Again, the hope is back, but there's a lot of challenges, there's a lot of obstacles, but at least for decades, we have the ability as Syrians to think of a better future. Nothing is done yet, but again, there's a lot of hope, and it will depend on the balance of forces within the country and the ability to constitute democratic, progressive bloc, challenging the Arab Kurdish division, on the ability of challenging these authoritarian local forces, but also regional and international forces, because none of them have the best interests of the Syrian popular classes.
We just have 30 seconds, but I just wanted to ask you about the significance of the finding of the corpse of Mazen al-Hamada. Tens of thousands of Syrians in Damascus now are gathering to attend his funeral.
Well, it's a tragedy like thousands, hundreds of thousands of other disappeared, forcibly disappeared, of political prisoners that we don't know what happened with them. This is a reflection of the barbarism of what was the Assad regime for the past 54 years, a regime that not only killed Syrians, but attacked Lebanese, occupied Lebanon, attacked Palestinians, Palestinian National Movement, and has been a center of authoritarianism and reactionary politics, not only for the Syrians, but for the whole region.
Joseph Daher, thank you so much for being with us. Swiss-Syrian left-wing scholar and activist in Geneva, Switzerland. We'll link to your recent piece for The New Arab, From Syria to Palestine, Liberation Comes from Below. And thanks also to Marwa Al-Savouni, the Syrian architect and writer in Homs in Syria. We lost our connection with her in the middle of the conversation. When we come back, we'll speak with Jan Egeland, the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's just left war-torn Ukraine. Stay with us. كانت حقيقة عكس كل شي حب كل شي حب كل شي حب تعال غني يا لو انت شي بقى One Day by Yusuf Kakhia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Ukraine, where residents are bracing for another winter of war as the UN estimates 60% of its electricity-generating capacity has been destroyed. Russian troops are now reportedly within 2 miles of the key eastern Ukrainian city of Pokrovsk. The Russian offensive comes just weeks before Donald Trump returns to the White House. Trump has threatened to reduce U.S. support to Ukraine. Trump recently met in Paris with French President Emmanuel Macron and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. After the meeting, Trump wrote, quote, "Zelensky and Ukraine would like to make a deal and stop the madness. There should be an immediate ceasefire and negotiations should begin," Trump wrote. Meanwhile, the Biden administration announced Saturday it would send a new $1 billion military aid package to Ukraine that includes drones and ammunition.
To talk more about the war in Ukraine, the humanitarian crisis there, we're joined by Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's joining us from Chisinau, Moldova, where he's just arrived after several days in Ukraine. Before that, we spoke to him after he had just left Gaza, saying he was broken and has recently been in Sudan. Jan Egeland, describe what you're seeing in Ukraine right now, as we here in the United States see in Paris President Trump-elect meeting with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Well, what I see and those with whom I met are all testament of this third Cold War winter becoming the worst. I've been five times now in Ukraine these last 3 years, and every time you come, people are more exhausted. They have less resources, there is less electricity, less water supply, and there is this relentless bombardment that has increased tremendously in recent weeks on civilian population. I was in one place that is really frontline. It's Kherson, was the one provincial capital that the Russians were able to take in their offensive in February, 2.5 years ago. That was then retaken by Ukrainian forces, but the Russians are on the other side of the river, Dnipro, next door. And there is multiple attacks every single day, including the day I was there. We meet in bomb shelters with the population. We serve and help them there. But we're able to create an office now there and do massive also cash relief. So it's so important that the United States and the other Western countries continue to support the Syrian people. What USAID is doing through us is giving tens of thousands of families much-needed cash assistance to survive this winter.
And Jan, if you could also speak about, you were in Kherson, but you were also in Odessa and Mykolaiv, if you could describe the situation on the ground there, and then also the difficulties in providing humanitarian assistance. In this year alone, 2024, dozens of humanitarian aid workers have been killed in Ukraine.
Yes, they have. Because the courageous humanitarian aid workers, especially from the local frontline organizations that we work with, are targeted like the civilian population. Even ambulances are repeatedly hit. First afternoon in Odessa, we had to go to the bomb shelter underneath the Norwegian Refugee Council bomb shelter in Odessa, because there was an alert of incoming ballistic missiles. They hit Zaporizhia, which is another city in the south, and a hospital was obliterated, really. I think it's now the toll is more than 10 dead, multiple wounded in a hospital, really. In Odessa, the ancient city of culture and civilization, there is blackouts all the time, as in Mykolaiv, which of course means that life is tough. And on top of that, hundreds of thousands of internally displaced from other locations in the south and from the east of Ukraine.
And the number of deaths of Ukrainian soldiers, also Russian soldiers, just astronomical. And the reports in Ukraine of recruiters going and almost basically abducting men to try to get them to the front line, people increasingly resisting. And where you see this heading around the issue of whether there would be any kind of negotiation at this point between Zelensky and Putin?
I mean, the population is exhausted. So imagine how it is in the trenches with those soldiers. Many of them have been continuously in battle for 2 years now or more. But what about the future? I mean, I think everybody yearn for peace, ceasefire, and end to the bombardment. But it's not very clear to see how they could agree on anything when one side says that they want to annex large parts of Ukraine and the other side says we want to liberate all parts of Ukraine. Hopefully there will be a ceasefire and there will be a negotiated end to this so that the civilian population that we serve can have a respite in the middle of this madness.
Well, Jan Egeland, just in the previous segment, we were talking about Syria. So I'd like to get your response to these extraordinary events in Syria in the last days. You were in Syria not long ago. And earlier this week, in terms of the response around the world, especially in countries where there are large numbers of Syrian refugees, Austria, although by no means the majority of Syrian refugees, Austria announced it will begin deporting Syrian refugees following the revolution that toppled Bashar al-Assad's regime. About 100,000 Syrians have resettled in Austria in the 13 years since Syria's civil war started. Meanwhile, the governments of Belgium, France, Greece, Germany, and the United Kingdom said they would pause applications for asylum by Syrians. More than 14 million people have fled Syria since 2011. You tweeted in response to this news, quote, "High European populist politicians, you want to push Syrian refugees back to these homes while foreign powers are still bombing, and no one knows how and who will be governing the various regions of the country. It would be cruel and reckless. Those who can will voluntarily return." So, Jan, if you could elaborate on this, first your response to Assad's ouster, and then this response from European governments about the status of Syrian refugees already there and applications from Syrians for asylum.
Mm. Yeah, and when I tweeted this that you quoted, I had a photo with it that I took myself only 4 weeks ago in Syria, where you have entire cities leveled to the ground and not rebuilt since the horrific civil war that was going on, continuously from 2012 to 2019. And I said, is it this rubble you want to deport people to? I know Syria well. I worked with it every week now since 2011. There is jubilation and anxiety on top of each other. And in Damascus, mostly jubilation, because those who have taken over say all of the right things at the moment. But in the northeast, there is a lot of fighting between and the various armed groups are taking territory from each other. Israel, Turkey, trying to bomb the place. The various groups that are now partly or fully in power were listed by many of these Western governments as terrorists, and then they want to deport people back. I think it's a testament how bad politics have become in Europe, and for that matter in the United States, that the idealism, the openness, the biblical saying, I was a stranger and you took me in, that's gone. Now people are looking at their own navel and really cherishing their nationalism and their xenophobia, it seems. I'm ashamed what are the signals coming out of one European country after the other. This is the time to invest in hope and possibilities in Syria, not to deport people back to a chaotic situation where they will have to live in rubble.
And Yana Eglin, before we go, we just wanted to address Sudan, which you've talked about as the worst crisis in the world. The headlines today, Sudan's military is accused of carrying out an airstrike on a marketplace in the western region of Darfur, in which more than 100 people were killed. Emergency lawyer rights group described the bombing as a horrific massacre. The fighting between the Rapid Defense Forces and Sudan and what needs to be done, the level of hunger there as well.
It's just tremendous. And these generals are really willing to fight each other to the last woman and child, it seems. I was in West Darfur, which was bombed 3 weeks ago, where I saw large parts of the city of Jenina ethnically cleansed from the Masalit people, the African tribe, by Arab militias, in this case. In other parts of the country, there is indiscriminate bombing, etc., etc. But there is also a lot of humanitarian, heroic aid workers on the ground, including the Norwegian Refugee Council, that with, again, assistance from the U.S. aid, is able to provide the daily subsidized bread to 1 million people every morning through 800-900 bakeries. So we're there. We're going to be fighting for the civilian population, but we need attention to this, the biggest crisis on earth, at the same time as the Middle East is in turmoil. Ukraine is having its worst winter. We need to really mobilize international solidarity in the months ahead.
And finally, we have just 30 seconds, but our headline today out of Gaza is the bombing of another humanitarian convoy in Gaza. An Israeli drone strike on a convoy west of Khan Yunis killed at least 13 people, injured dozens of others. You were not just in Sudan and Ukraine, but also we spoke to you right after you came out of Gaza and you said you were broken by that.
Yeah, and it's a pattern. This civilian population and these women in general had nothing to do with the horrors inflicted on Israel on the 7th of October. They are innocent and they are bombed and they are starved by this besiegement from Israel with American arms and American support. It's the worst part of the Biden administration's foreign policy. Hopefully that will change, because it's costing the United States and the Western powers, really. They look at hypocrisy. How come occupation by Russia and Ukraine is bad and it's tolerable when Israel is doing exactly the same?
Jan Egeland, I want to thank you for being with us. Secretary General of Norwegian Refugee Council joining us from Chisinau, Moldova, where he's just arrived after several days in Ukraine, before that Sudan, before that in Gaza. Coming up, we look at what some are calling Donald Trump's Me Too cabinet, from Pete Hegseth to Linda McMahon to Trump himself. A number of Trump's cabinet picks have been accused of sexual misconduct or covering it up. Stay with us. Ukrainian dream by Origin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show looking at what some are calling Donald Trump's Me Too cabinet, from Pete Hegseth to Linda McMahon to Trump himself. A number of Trump's cabinet picks have been accused of sexual misconduct or covering up sexual abuse. Trump's early pick of former Florida Congressmember Matt Gaetz for attorney general was shot down after at least four Republican senators opposed his confirmation over sexual misconduct allegations. Now Trump is pushing hard to keep the rest of his picks on track, including former Fox host Pete Hegseth for defense secretary and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for health and human services secretary. Hegseth paid an undisclosed amount to a woman who accused him of sexual assault and has called for eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion practices from the military. Meanwhile, RFK has been accused by his children's former babysitter of sexual abuse. Even one of the few women Trump has chosen, Linda McMahon for education secretary, the former executive with World Wrestling Entertainment, faces allegations that she and her husband, Vince McMahon, failed to stop a ringside announcer from sexually assaulting young boys in the 1980s and 90s. Vince McMahon has also been accused of raping a WWF referee.
For more, we're joined by Deborah Turkheimer, professor of law at Northwestern University, author of Credible, Why We Doubt Accusers and Protect Abusers. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Turkheimer. There's so much to talk about here. You have a huge onslaught against the Iowa Republican Senator Ernst, who herself is a lieutenant colonel in the Iowa National Guard, was raising serious questions about defense secretary nominee Hegseth, herself a sexual assault survivor. But last weekend, there was an enormous onslaught as a result of an ad campaign against her in Iowa. This after the election, but she's up in 2026, getting her to support Hegseth. Talk about the significance of what he's been charged with and go through them one by one right up to President-elect Trump.
Well, I think it's important to go back in time all the way to 2016 on the release of that Access Hollywood tape. Recall that Donald Trump was heard boasting about what he and other powerful men could do to women. And for many women who heard that, I think it really stood in for male entitlement and the very real notion that men could get away with anything. This is, of course, in the midst of Donald Trump's facing multiple allegations of sexual abuse in the court of public opinion. In the course of researching my book, I heard repeatedly that for many women, this was really about what had been done to them as well. And I say this because I think it helps us to understand the explosion of the Me Too movement just about a year later. It's not widely understood that Donald Trump had any connection to the Me Too movement, but I think he really seeded the ground for what came about after his election. As one woman said to me, the idea that structures are in place to protect men like Donald Trump enabled me to come forward with my own allegations. So if we fast forward, of course, to the presidency, to Donald Trump's statements around Brett Kavanaugh's nomination, the notion that this is a as Donald Trump described it, a very scary time for young men in America, the idea that women lie when they come forward with allegations of abuse, and then, of course, Donald Trump's own finding against him, finding of civil liability for the sexual abuse of writer E. Jean Carroll. And we come to this latest election. I think it's fair to say that Trump really is the embodiment of a male entitlement that is much on the minds of people who are watching these cabinet nominations. there's really a contest over what set of norms applies in the world.
Well, Deborah, the last time Trump won in 2017, at the same time as his inauguration, there was a massive women's march opposing him as president. Do you see a similar mobilization now, especially in light of the cabinet picks, not just him, but his cabinet picks?
My sense is that the opposition, the resistance, the mobilization is more targeted this time around. And so rather than a big march in Washington, groups are focusing their efforts on the particular issues that they may be able to make progress on. And so the decision of Matt Gaetz to step down, I think, was widely seen as a small but significant victory in this effort, again, to sort of reclaim or claim a set of norms around sexual abuse. Because, of course, the Me Too movement was about and continues to be about not just individual allegations, but this larger question of who's held accountable and what kind of cultural toleration do we have for abuse by powerful men.
And we also want to ask you about McMahon, who has been nominated for education secretary, though, to say the least, not involved with education.
Right. So I want to be clear that the nomination of Alinda McMahon for the Department of Education or Pete Hegseth for the Department of Defense, these are not only expressions that have symbolic value about which worldview is controlling, but there are also tangible consequences that flow. These are certainly agencies with their own fraught histories around responding to sexual abuse allegations. And so it's very meaningful who's at the very top of these agencies and what kinds of attitudes, orientations they bring to the job. It's very concerning for anyone who cares about justice for survivors to contemplate the heads of these agencies being individuals not only with their own sets of allegations, but also very clearly expressed views about these allegations, whether they ought to be taken seriously, whether they ought to be pursued, whether there ought to be accountability for those who perpetrate these kinds of harms.
And very interesting that the people who are raising questions at this point, even under enormous pressure, are the Republican and Democratic women senators who will be confirming or not these nominations.
Yes, this is, these are political questions in the end, and it will be very interesting to see whether the view of a majority of Americans, in latest polling, it's very clear that nearly two-thirds of Americans believe that sexual assault allegations are disqualifying when it comes to these kinds of positions, these very high-level positions. Whether we continue to protect people who commit these kinds of abuses has everything to do with whether we are able to upend the structures that provide this kind of impunity.
Finally, Trump is ringing the opening bell of the New York Stock Exchange today, just blocks from the Manhattan courthouse where he became the first former president to be convicted of felony. We'll leave it there. Deborah Turkheimer, professor of law at Northwestern University, author of Credible, Why We Doubt Accusers and Protect Abusers. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a jolly, merry, happy, joyful, fantastic, exciting, fancy, magnificent, remarkable, special, white, sparkling, terrific, stunning, festive, and wonderful holiday season.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
Quelle est l'importance de cette station pour vous? Une station locale, des nouvelles et des informations qui comptent. Vous ne trouverez rien de tel ailleurs. Maintenant, nous avons besoin de vous, de votre voix, pour soutenir l'initiative des radios communautaires. La radio a été là pour vous dans des moments importants et maintenant c'est à votre tour. Vous pouvez vous joindre à la lutte pour l'avenir de la radio communautaire sur monirc.ca. Encore monirc.ca, des voix locales qui façonnent notre communauté.